Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast, brought to you by the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It is our goal to advance the understanding of honeybees and beekeeping, grow the beekeeping community, and improve the health of honeybees everywhere. In this podcast, you'll hear research updates, beekeeping management practices discussed, and advice on beekeeping from our resident experts, beekeepers, scientists, and other program guests. Join us for today's program, and thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Two Bees in a Podcast. Today, I am excited, extremely excited to be introducing Dr. Priya Chakrabarti Basu, who is an assistant professor in pollinator health and apiculture with the Department of Biochemistry, Molecular Biology, Entomology, and Plant Pathology at Mississippi State University. She is also a courtesy faculty at Oregon State University. I'm excited to be introducing Priya because her and I, we actually met at an entomological society conference in Puerto Rico a couple of years ago. I'm excited to share her work. She's got great research going on. So thank you so much, Priya, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Amy and Jamie, for having me today. I'm excited to talk about our lab and what we do.
I know. I can't believe we've had this podcast for 3 years now and we haven't had you on. So it's
I know,
like,
shame
it's
on
crazy.
Us, right?
I know, right? Like, how in the world have we not had you on yet? But I'm glad to finally be able to do that today. But before we get into the interview, I was wondering if you can tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your beekeeping experience.
I originally come from India. So my PhD is from India and a part of it is from England. I studied the impacts of pesticides on wild honeybees across India. I also studied the impacts of pesticides on bumblebee gustation in England. And that's how I sort of got into bees. When I started my PhD, bee research wasn't that broadly looked into back in Asia or in India. So which is why what we did was quite unique at that point of time. And then I moved to Oregon State Bee Lab as a postdoc, and eventually I got this position here about 2 years ago at Mississippi State University. My beekeeping experience is honestly very limited. I started off as a bee researcher, and only when I started keeping hives for research, I started more and more learning about beekeeping. But it is extremely varied because I had to learn what beekeepers in India did. Then I also started working with beekeepers in England, and then I started working with beekeepers in the US. So my beekeeping experience in that way, if you look at it, it's actually very varied. And it's got sort of like a global perspective into what you do, depending on what type of bees you keep and where you're located in the world.
So Priya, I'm also excited to have you as part of this interview. I will tell you, we do a little bit of nutrition research, at least we have recently, with some pollen substitute stuff. And everywhere I go and talk about it, people are like, well, have you met Priya? She does all this. And it's like, you have your fingers in all types of honeybee nutrition research. We're going to talk about that coming up. But before we get to that, you know, your lab is brand new. Right. And so you get a chance to do what you want to do. You get a chance to kind of get a pulse of the beekeeping industry and determine what it is that they need so you can build your research program around it. Can you tell us a little bit about your lab, the research projects that you undertake, kind of the grand vision that you have? Do you have teaching, research, and extension appointments, all of that kind of stuff? Could you kind of tell us who you are and what you do now?
Our lab is brand new, as you said. Honestly, when I started, it was 2021 August, and we were at the very tail end of COVID. So essentially, we were a little struggling when we started because anything we ordered was always out of stock or it had a long waiting list to be delivered. By the time we actually effectively were able to start our lab, it was already May or June in 2022. But I've got some amazing students. I have 4 graduate students in the lab. I have over 10 undergrads working currently this semester in the lab. I also have a full-time research associate. They are all amazing people, you know, very passionate about everything that we do. And I honestly have to say these wonder grads in the lab, they help move the hive forward. We look at all things related with the different stressors that are affecting honeybees, especially poor nutrition, as you mentioned. We also investigate these different stressors. How are they impacting bees individually? What are their synergistic impacts? And what can we do to mitigate such stress? So essentially, we primarily study poor nutrition. We study pesticide impacts on bees. We study how climate change or the environment is affecting bee nutrition as well as the other aspects of bee health. We also look at how these different stressors are interacting with each other. We use many different techniques such as multi-omics. We used bee physiology. We use basic apicultural practices, bee behavior, neuroethology. So we use many different combinations of both lab and field efforts in trying to tease apart these different stressors. And my position is very unique. I have a research and teaching appointment, but outreach is also a component. So even though I do not have directly an extension appointment, I mean, Jamie, you know, right? You and Amy, you both know, no matter what we do, extension is a part of it, being a bee researcher, because we really have to be able to translate our research to our stakeholders.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, part of what we do is in the podcast, especially, is connect beekeepers with research and understanding research, understanding what research is being published and kind of the process of that as well. And so I'd love to talk to you a little bit more and ask you about some of maybe the strengths and challenges that you have come across being a new lab. You know, Jamie, you've been established here, and the honeybee program has been established here for quite some time. And so it's kind of hard to think about like starting brand new and fresh. Like what are some of your favorite parts and maybe challenges that you've come across so far?
I have to say, Jamie intimidates me. I mean, he runs this massive program and it's extremely successful. I'm sure he started somewhere as we did at some point of time, but Jamie, you're definitely inspiring when we try to establish a bee program. When I started, I definitely had a lot of help from Mississippi State University, from the department, from the college to help me start with the lab. So I got the lab space that I needed. I also got the equipment that I needed to be able to start. You know, the main challenge, as I was saying, was really starting off at the tail end of COVID, because we really couldn't get anything that we were ordering. So here I am trying to envision a lab, sitting in my office. Even my printer for my office was on a 5-month waiting time. So it was that bad when we started. But honestly, the primary strength that I could think of at this time is just strength of this community at Mississippi State University, how everybody sort of came together and helped me get this lab going. And right now, my lab is supported by these amazing graduate and undergraduate students who really are extremely passionate, extremely enthusiastic about the work that we do. And we are excited I can see where this lab is headed. And I'm really excited for all the potentials and the opportunities that we have.
I love that, Priya. It sounds like you have a big vision for where you guys want to go. And honestly, like in my experience leading a lab, it's the vision that really counts. You know, a lot of people get down into the weeds and they forget that they're working towards something. And it sounds like you have that grand vision. You know what direction you want to go and you're taking the steps necessary to get there. And as I mentioned a little earlier, I'm really super duper excited that you are tackling, among the other things that you've discussed, honeybee nutrition. And I'll tell you why. When Amy and I talk about it, when we look at the beekeeper data, it's very clear that varroa nutrition and queen related issues are kind of the big issues facing the bee world. And a lot of folks work on varroa control. A lot of folks work on queen quality and things like that. But I would say nutrition, heck, I was given a talk last night where I made this statement, where I said nutrition represents one of the greatest opportunities for improvement in honeybee health and management. And you're tackling this idea head on. And so Amy and I are going to ask you a series of questions all related to really big nutritional efforts that you were undertaking. And the first of those is a nutrition database that you and your team are building. Can you tell us a little bit about that nutrition database, what it is and what it means for beekeepers?
Absolutely. We are actually building three different databases. So the first is this giant effort that Ramesh Sagili from Oregon State and I, we've started about 3 years ago. This is the pollen nutrition database that we are building for all bees in North America. It is a citizen science as well as a scientist-driven project. So we have over 54 citizen scientists across US and Canada. We are trying to either hand collect pollen or use honeybee pollen foragers and collect the pollen from their hind legs. So we are collecting pollen from any plant that is visited by a bee. It could be a honeybee, it could be a bumblebee, it could be any bee species. As long as a bee goes to that plant for collecting pollen, we are trying to collect pollen from those plants. We have initially targeted for about 100 plants for the first 3 years, and this is supported by USDA AFRI. So we are trying to collect at least pollen from 100 plants. And honestly, I look at it as a lifelong project for me because there are just so many types of plants in the landscape. Crops, non-crop forage, horticultural plants, ornamental plants. There is this wide variety of plants that we would like to study. So we are looking into the pollen nutrition quality. We want to look at both the macro and the micronutrients. So we are looking at proteins, we are looking at lipids, we are looking at phytosterols, amino acids, metabolites. So we really want to look deep into these plants because honestly, at this point, we do have these incredible planting recommendations from a lot of different sources. But when you look at these, how much do we really know about the nutritional quality of the plants that we are planting in our habitat? I often tell this and people laugh at me because, you know, if you offer me a bowl of salad versus a bowl of French fries, I will go for the French fries because I'm attracted to it. Not necessarily it is healthy for me. Similarly, if you're planting something in the habitat, bees may visit it for so many different reasons. It could be relatively attractive to them because of the way they look, because of the proximity of the plant to the hive, just or maybe because the nectar is too sweet. So there are so many different facets to understanding why a bee is visiting a particular plant. But one important thing that we are lacking in information is having this understanding of the nutritional quality of those plants in the habitat. And we are going to make this database publicly available for anyone and everyone to be able to look through these plants, look at the pollen nutrition quality, and eventually say that, all right, this time of the year, this is what grows in my area. How about I plant a combination of maybe these five different things? This has high proteins, this has high lipids, this has high phytosterols. So as a combination, it can really provide the whole diverse spectrum of both macro and micronutrients to any bees that are visiting in our backyard or in our, you know, in this habitat. So that's the main idea behind the pollen nutrition database. We are also going to study the commercial diets that are available in the market and look at their nutritional quality, because at the end of the day, if a beekeeper wants to supplement their colonies with these commercial diets during times of pollen dearth in the landscape, we want them to have access to either the diets that are more healthy for the colonies or use a combination of different things to be able to provide a whole diverse spectrum of nutrients to the bees. The second database that I'm working on currently is creating a phenology wheel for the beekeepers in the Southeast region. And I've started with Southeast. I'm definitely hoping to expand it to the rest of the US. I have partnered with Dr. Pierre Lau at Stoneville USDA ARS. So what we are doing currently is that we are recruiting beekeepers as our citizen scientists across the Southeast. And Jeff has a couple of beekeepers who are helping us collect from Alabama. Jamie, if you know of anyone who would like to join this effort, it would be fantastic for us. So we are requesting that our beekeepers, we will ship pollen traps to them. All they need to do is trap for pollen once a month during the same time for 12 calendar months for 2 days each month during bright sunny days when bees are bringing in pollen. Our students in the lab, in my lab, we are color sorting the pollen. We are staining the pollen with different techniques. And we are trying to not only identify the plant, we are also looking at the pollen nutritional quality of the plants. And this project is supported by Project APSM. So what we are doing is essentially at the end of 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, we are hoping to run this for at least 3 to 4 years. We will be able to have some really important data coming from here. Not only, suppose say, for example, say here is a beekeeper. He has his bees in a particular location in the southeast region. In March, he sees a yellow color pollen coming in that region. Based on our database, he could potentially narrow down to what plant the bee is visiting, what does the pollen look like, and what is the nutritional quality of that pollen. So that is what we want to do. And as an offshoot from this database, what we are also building is a palynology database, which will also be freely accessible, easily accessible to everyone. The pollen that we are collecting through the Phenology Wheel project, we are color sorting them, we are imaging them, we are staining them, we are also re-imaging them under the microscope. So essentially, for palynologists or for bee nutrition enthusiasts, this would be a fantastic database to look at, you know, what the different plant pollens look like, essentially telling us what the bees have access to. So these are primarily the three different databases that we are building.
Priya, I have so many. Well, you and I already talked about this before the podcast, but you and I could probably sit down, and if people don't interrupt us, we will go back and forth and just talk forever, right? And I'm amazed, and I'm so excited for your databases. I think that they're going to be extremely useful for beekeepers. I'm excited to see the results. Also, be careful what you wish for, because now I'm just thinking even we can collect samples for you here at the lab and take part in that. And I know that we've got Florida beekeepers and other beekeepers in the Southeast that are listening to this podcast that would love to take part in helping you sample for pollen.
Fantastic, Amy. And honestly, one thing I forgot to mention is that when we run this every year, so suppose say for the beekeeper-driven Phenology Wheel database, you know, suppose say year one, you're collecting your pollen samples during the first week of every month. Then in year two, we shift it to the second week. Then in year three, we shift it to the third week of every month. This way, we are hoping to collect both the major and the minor blooms. And it might even tell us if we are losing plants in the landscape or we are gaining plants in the landscape, or, you know, what's happening with the phenology of these plants.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like that's a question that I receive pretty, I would say that almost half of the emails that we receive is always, you know, we're wondering what plants our bees are foraging on, right? And so yes, that I think would be extremely useful for beekeepers. So yeah, thank you for doing that. And I'm excited for your vision and your research.
Thank you.
All right. So I'm switching gears just a little bit. So this project and what you have just discussed was covered the United States. You are also involved with nutrition projects, specifically with COLOS, and COLOS is the International Colony Loss Organization, and you're also working with them. And so I think just as a general overall question, can you talk to us about the COLOS Nutritional Survey, what that is, who's involved? And then also for our beekeepers listening, you know, we have beekeepers all over the world that are listening, but how can people get involved? You know, whether they're beekeepers in the United States, whether they're beekeepers in the Southeast, or whether they're beekeepers outside the United States. What are your thoughts, and can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you brought that up, because with COLOS, we are really trying to gain an understanding of bee nutrition practices amidst different beekeepers across the world. So even though I am currently trying to gain this understanding in North America, we really have these surveys that have been distributed to beekeeping groups across the world. We want to understand what what does nutrition mean to the beekeepers? What do they think about poor nutrition? What do they think about good nutrition? What are the supplementary nutritional practices that they have in their beekeeping practices? So for example, say I'm a beekeeper, I could be based in Canada, or I could be based in the US, I could even be based back in India. But for me, what time of the year do I think that my bees are stressed nutritionally? How do I know that they are stressed? What do I think about it? And what do I do? So that's the main crux of that survey. So what do I do if I have to intervene and provide nutritional supplements? It could be proteins, it could be carbohydrates, but what do I feed to the bees? How do I assess nutritional markers in the colony? So this is like a nutrition survey that we are doing. We are trying to gain a better understanding of what our current practices are. How does it change across the different regions? And so all of the survey results, not only will we distribute that to the survey participants, we will also make that publicly available. Because at the end of the day, this will also help us, people like me who study bee nutrition, understand better than what the current general trend is and what can we do to either help beekeepers out or improve on what we know currently. So that's what the survey is about. If there is any beekeeper who would like to participate in the US, I have tried my best to reach out to every state honeybee lab and distribute it. But if you are listening to this and if you have not received a link to the survey, if you would like to participate, please, please reach out to me. My email is pb1090@mstate.edu. If you reach out to me, I will be very happy to share a link for the survey. We really want your participation because all of this is to help us help you better.
So thanks, Shapriya. I really appreciate that because it is a very big international effort and it's going to provide a lot of very useful data, I think, for beekeepers all around the world. And since this podcast has an international audience, I think that that's a very relevant thing to discuss. And so let's transition now to another nutrition level effort that you are helping to lead, or actually leading this particular one. In the U.S., there's a group called the Honeybee Health Coalition that really just kind of exists to address honeybee husbandry related topics, and you are leading the development of the Honeybee Health Coalition's Guide to Honeybee Nutrition. And the reason I think this is significant is because the Honeybee Health Coalition has an amazing varroa control guide and beekeeping management guide, all kinds of things that are free to beekeepers here and around the world. And it needed a nutrition guide, and you are tackling that effort. And I think it's going to have international implications. It's one of those things that beekeepers everywhere potentially could use. So could you tell us a bit about the history of the guide, your involvement, where it's heading, when it might be produced, all of those types of things?
Yes, sure. So thank you, Jamie, for introducing Honeybee Health Coalition, because they are really doing a fantastic work of bringing in all of the important topics related to honeybee husbandry, apiculture, and how we can tackle the problems. So this guide, it sort of came along when I was talking with Danielle at Project APSN and Matt Malka at Honeybee Health Coalition. We sort of got together and we decided that it was really important that we start building a honeybee nutrition guide. And we have another beekeeper from the US, George Hansen, who also kind of co-led this effort. So what we're essentially looking into is that, so this will be a multi-series guide. The very first part that we are currently focusing on is just looking at supplementary feeding. And Jamie, you do some amazing work with the pollen supplements and bee nutrition. So you know how complex this entire topic is. Not only do we have to deal with the habitat storage and what bees have access to in the landscape, we also have to look into what are the different types of commercial diets and supplementary feeding that we provide to the colonies. So it is multifaceted when we look at it. So the very first part of this guide is going to focus on providing supplementary feeding to the colonies, be it commercial diets or homemade diets, or be it sugar supplementation. So this guide currently is going to focus on what are the best practices, what are the different ways we can provide supplemental nutrition to the colony, We are also going to try and cover interviews with beekeepers across the different regions in North America and see what their different beekeeping practices are. Based on that, how do they nutritionally supplement their colonies? What has worked for them? What they would advise? What hasn't worked for them? This, you know, working on this guide, it was not only incredibly, I would say, intimidating, but also extremely rewarding. I learned so much through this entire process, and I am beginning to appreciate the complexity that bee nutrition overall is, you know, more and more every day. I actually have referred to a lot of your studies, Jamie, on pollen supplements when I was working on this guide itself. But I'm hoping that this guide, we will be able to get it ready before the end of this year. Because in North America, we have this big meeting coming up in January, American Bee Conference. So we are hoping to have all of this done before it, and then we have something ready for the beekeepers in January.
Priya, I feel like, you know, as you're talking and telling us about your research and everything that you've been involved in, I feel like you're creating this menu, right? A menu for honeybees. And I can't help but to think you're the honeybee nutritional coach. And I'm excited. I'm excited for that. So I probably should have introduced you as that, the honeybee nutritional coach.
I try my best. I'm not a great dietitian when it comes to myself, but I think what do bees need and what they really need to eat?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to switch gears just a little bit. So I know that you've just recently received a new USDA grant, and this has to do with evaluating the impacts of climate change on pollen and nectar producing plants. And so I kind of want to just finish off by asking you about the grant that you received and what your objectives are, and maybe just a little history behind that as well.
Sure. This is a very new grant that we received. It's a USDA New Investigator Award that we got from AFRI Pollinator Health Program. We know that our environment is changing. When we are talking about bee nutrition, we also need to look at it from the plant perspective. A lot of these plants, either they undergo drought stress or they undergo heat stress. They might even undergo flooding. So what primarily interests us is that when we are talking about bee forage, bees are really dependent on these plants. So if the plants undergo any of these environmental stressors, what is it doing to the plant pollen quality, to the plant nectar quality, or overall even to the plant health and physiology? Because if bees are dependent on these plants, we really need to make sure that the plants are healthy and they are providing sufficient resources for the bees. So that is what primarily the project is about. I have a new grad student who's working on this project. We have partnered with plant physiologists here at Mississippi State as well as Oregon State. We are looking at 2 to 3 different plants that bees commonly rely on for pollen and nectar. And what we really want to understand is that if we stress out these plants, say, for example, heat stress or drought stress or any other climatic stress, how is it affecting overall plant health and the quality of the pollen and nectar that they're producing? If these plants are able to propagate well with enough resources, only then will bees have access to good quality nutrition in the landscape. So that is what we are also currently looking into.
So Priya, you're clearly involved very heavily in honeybee nutrition. That's great. But I know you've got a few other things happening. You've got some pesticide work. You've even published a children's book on honeybees. Could you tell us briefly about those two things?
Sure, Jamie. Our lab also looks at bee toxicology. So our primary interest is, what are the different types of pesticides that bees can be exposed to in the landscape? What the field relevant doses are? How are they interacting with each other? What are their additive or synergistic effects? And we want to work with both groups of stakeholders, because we really work at the interface of both crop protection and bee protection. So we really want to we work with both groups of stakeholders, and we would like to see what are the safe tank mixes for bees, what are the effects of the pesticides that are commonly bees are exposed to, and what can we do to mitigate such stress. And for the honeybee book that actually came along about a year ago, I worked with Macmillan Publishers. They have this amazing series on for children. So it's called Neon Squid, and they have a series called Young Zoologist. They have tapped into global experts on individual topics. So they had reached out to me for honeybees, and we worked together to actually build this. It's a pretty cute book. It's called Young Zoologist, Honeybees. And even though these are like bite-sized sciencey nuggets for children, it's actually for both kids and adults. And I truly believe that STEM starts young, and I would like to raise pollinator awareness not only among the older audience, but also among children. So this book is a first step towards it in raising pollinator awareness. And what can we do to help bees?
Yeah, this is all great information, Priya. I am excited to share with our listeners. So we'll be sure to link your website, and anybody can have access to your email address and all these other projects that you've brought up. I'm super excited to have you. We'll definitely have to have you on again. I feel like this was just kind of a SparksNotes version of what you do in the lab, because I know that there's just so much that you do. So we'll have to have you on again, and we're excited to have had you on today. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was an amazing conversation, and thank you both so much for having me.
Thanks, Priya.
Well, Jamie, I sound like a broken record, but I really enjoyed having Priya on the podcast, and I am super excited about just honeybee nutrition. And, to be quite honest, you can teach nutrition. I can teach nutrition, but every time we have a bee college, I'm like, who can teach the nutrition? And I feel like she is the perfect person. So now we have to have Priya at Bee College, speaking about honeybee nutrition, but I'm excited to see where her research goes.
Absolutely. She's got a great personality. She's very enthusiastic about her work. And beyond that, she's doing good work. And when you put all of those things together, you really get someone who's exciting to be around, who's very motivated. And I know she talked a little bit about things she's doing here in the US, and that we have an international audience for this podcast, but what she's doing is relevant internationally. And I think the thing that's impressing me the most is she's addressing nutrition from two angles, both what we provide artificially through our pollen substitute patties and things like that, but also what bees encounter in the wild. And so she's looking at nutrition from a what can we plant perspective, as well as a what can we provide directly to colonies perspective. And her climate change grant, as an example, is very forward thinking. Whether or not, we all know that climate change, at least in the US, is a very political issue. It should just be a science issue, but it's a very political issue. And outside the US, it's less of a problem that way. But beekeepers, through their surveys, regularly every year report how weather impacts their bees. Well, this is just another way weather impacts their bees. It impacts their forage. And Priya and colleagues are addressing all of these issues head on, while not just doing research, but also providing tools to and for beekeepers. For example, these databases that she discussed. So it's a very well thought out strategy to address honeybee nutrition from a research and extension perspective.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited. We're always sharing the Honeybee Health Coalition information, and I think just her involvement with the nutrition survey and having that available, beekeepers can go. I'm happy to share, research that all these other great researchers are doing and just providing things that are very practical for beekeepers. So I'm excited to share that information, and hopefully our listeners will use this information and start using it on a regular basis to change some of their management, whether that's feeding or, as you mentioned, what they're planting during a specific time of year.
Amy, you said something when you were interviewing Priya that was very profound, and then it was consistent with what you just said here to the audience. You said to Priya, in kind of your introductory comment, is that we look for the researchers who are experts in certain topics. We introduce those researchers to the beekeeping world through this podcast so that the beekeepers know who they can reach out to with specific issues. That's true. That's one of the purposes of this podcast. And now the world knows, among other folks, that Priya is another individual they can reach out to with honeybee nutrition-related questions. I'll say, too, while we're talking and recognizing our international audience, Priya is active with this Kolos Nutritional Survey. Well, Kolos, you know, the prevention of honeybee colony losses effort, they have a honeybee nutrition branch, a working group in their organization. And it's actively made up, composed of scientists who are working, you know, around the clock to study honeybee nutrition. So wherever you are on planet Earth managing honeybees of any type, nutrition's always a big issue. And it's something when we manage, we have to provide it, or we have to make sure the landscape's got ample nutrition available to support the bees. And you're right, Amy, we're trying to provide links to beekeepers, to those scientists who are on the cutting edge of these types of topics.
It's everybody's favorite game show, Stump the Chump.
All right, welcome back to the question and answer segment. Jamie, you know, we've been talking a lot about honeybee nutrition lately, and I feel like a couple of months ago, you did the at-home beekeeping series, and that is just an online at-home beekeeping series that's a collaboration with other land-grant universities. And it's just been, there are a couple of hundred people who call in, and they're just really excited. They're there asking questions. And for the at-home beekeeping series, you talked a lot about the research that Emily Nordyke, who is our previous master's student, did with pollen substitutes. And so what we'll do is maybe we'll just spend the next two Q&A segments working and asking questions about honeybee nutrition and pollen subs. What do you think?
I think that's a good idea. Yeah, it's a very hot topic. You know, we've even discussed, we've interviewed Emily on our podcast. We've talked about these topics before, but I do feel like having a couple of Q&As centered around this idea would be good for beekeepers.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. So we'll start with the first question. The first one is related to feeding bees pollen subs. Should someone trap, let's say someone wants to feed their bees natural pollen, and I guess, how do you do this? And should they try to trap as much natural pollen as possible? And then what do? You add it to a pollen patty, or what are your recommendations for pollen subs and or just kind of feeding natural pollen or mixing them together?
Yeah. So Amy, those are all good questions. I'm going to give a little bit of background for our listeners, you know, who weren't able to join the stay-at-home beekeeping seminar I gave a few months ago. The research on pollen subs is actually quite mixed. Sometimes when scientists would put pollen subs into colonies, they get a positive response. Sometimes they get a negative response. Sometimes they get a neutral response. And one of the ways that scientists have been able to get consistently positive responses is if they mix natural pollen into the pollen subs, which then begs the question, is it the natural pollen that's doing the work rather than the pollen subs? So we got a question, you know, well, maybe instead of pollen subs, should I just collect as much natural pollen as possible when pollen is flowing in and then use it later when I'm feeding bees subs? And the answer is, yeah, it's possible. You know, there's not a ton of research on feeding colonies just pollen patties. That would be pollen patties made exclusively of pollen. There's more research on feeding pollen supplements or substitutes, which are, you know, these artificial things that are available into which you might mix a little bit of pollen. So what I would argue is that right now there's not enough research out to make you want to go and collect pollen as much as you can and then later feed it back in patty form. That said, if you do feed pollen substitutes, especially commercially available pollen substitutes, I do feel that you'll get more bang for your buck if you are mixing natural pollen into those substitutes. And if that's the case, you might actually want to trap pollen, you know, during good pollen trapping seasons, freeze it and mix it into pollen sub later. But I think one of the questions coming up either in this episode or in a later episode is really, should I be feeding pollen subs at all? And I'll answer that later. But the point with this question is, you know, should I trap pollen to use it later? More often than not, no. But if you are someone who uses pollen subs a lot, then you might consider trapping pollen, mixing it into your pollen subs, because I really do feel it'll improve the impact of the pollen subs in the colony.
Yeah, so as we're talking about, you know, storing pollen, just natural pollen, bees will take pollen, they turn it into bee bread, and they store it, right? And so when you're looking at bee bread, is old bee bread, you know, bee bread that's maybe been there for a while, is that still a viable source? Is that still, I mean, it's a quality of protein and that's still good. Do you have an answer for that?
Yeah, so I actually do have an answer for that, serendipitously enough. So I also do the Q&A for the American Bee Journal, and I got a question from a beekeeper for the American Bee Journal that's essentially just like this. In fact, I wonder if it's the same individual asking the question. But they said, you know, the longer that bee bread remains in the hive, does it lose some of its nutritive quality to bees? And the answer is yes. I was able to find a couple of research papers where scientists were looking at the nutritive quality of stored bee bread, you know, after 6-9 months a year. And they found that after a year, for sure, the quality of nutrition that bees get out of bee bread is definitely lower. And for the most part, bee bread won't be in colonies that long anyway, because the bees are eating it in near real time or within weeks or maybe a month or two. But there are certainly circumstances under which that there will be bee bread stockpiled in times of dearth. But if it's older than about a year, then it definitely starts, it's not useless to bees, but it definitely starts providing less and less nutrition to the bees. And the good news is it will ultimately be replaced pretty quickly once a major pollen flow starts.
Mm-hmm. All right. So for the last question, and this is a question that we receive pretty often, is that do you notice an increase in small hive beetles when, if you're using pollen subs versus real pollen? And I guess, you know, I'll just add on to that as well. Do you see an increase in small hive beetles in general if you're going to feed with different pollen subs?
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that question. I started studying small hive beetles, gosh, now let me think. 20 plus years ago, that's hard to imagine. And one of the earliest things that I published with some colleagues is some colleagues of mine found that when you mix, back in the day, you could feed bees grease patties with sugar in them, and it would coat the bees and be a way to effectively control tracheal mites. And they were mixing antibiotics in there and things like that. Well, we've showed that small hive beetles were attracted to that, and then subsequently were attracted to pollen subs. And as you might imagine, because small hive beetles reproduce on protein, especially pollen, when you provide a pollen sub into a colony, you increase the risk that that colony is going to have a small hive beetle problem. So the best way to administer pollen subs to colonies is in a manner that allows the bees near complete access to pollen subs. Otherwise, you do run the risk of beetles getting into those pollen subs. So what do I mean when I say near complete access? Well, historically, it is common for if a hive is composed of multiple boxes, for the beekeeper to go to the lowest most box in the hive, right? The lowest box in the hive, which is usually the brood chamber, take off all the other boxes above it, place the pollen patty on top of the frames in that lowest box in the hive, and then stack the other boxes back on top of that lowest box. And what that does is it squeezes the pollen patty between the brood chamber its own and the super that's immediately above it. And when you squeeze the pollen patty that way, you provide a lot of pockets of pollen patty that bees are unable to access, but that beetles can access. And you'll get beetles squeezing into those pockets and laying eggs, and the next thing you know, there's an explosion of beetle larvae in the hive. So when we administer pollen subs for research purposes, we will often put a rim around that lowest box, which raises the super above it so that the bees have complete access to the top and the sides of that pollen patty. So what do I mean by that? Well, there are wooden-bound queen excluders. Imagine the wooden bound queen excluder without the excluder material. It's just that wooden square that goes on top of the lowest box. Mm-hmm. And that creates, you know, a few centimeters gap between the brood chamber and the next super above it. And that gives bees complete access. So a lot of commercial beekeepers won't do this if their beetle numbers are low, right? Because that's an extra thing that you have to put on the hives, which is this wooden frame. But in our case, if we if we worry about beetles attacking pollen subs, we will definitely put that rim on. The downside of having that rim on is if you use it during a major nectar flow, it increases the space and bees will build burr comb in that area. But if you do it outside of a nectar flow, it's usually not a problem and can be a reasonable way to keep the beetle pressures low on those pollen subs while they're in your hives.
Yeah. So the second part of that question is, so let's say you do have a ton of small hive beetle. Do you have any thoughts on using brewer's yeast fermenting and attracting beetles or anything that may attract the beetles away from the pollen?
Well, in this case, so I've never heard a question like this, and it's very insightful from the person who's asking the question, because brewer's yeasts can be mixed into pollen subs because some folks believe that they are that is a very beneficial ingredient in pollen subs. And so I'm not going to talk about whether it's beneficial or not. I would say the jury's still out there. But the beekeeper saying, it sounds like the beekeeper normally mixes brewer's yeast into his or her pollen subs. And so the question is that going to attract more beetles? And the answer is, we don't know. It's never been studied. We don't know for sure if brewer's yeast is something that attracts beetles. But they did mention that word fermenting, and that's crucial to understanding this question. Because when small hive beetles work in or around pollen, they can deposit a yeast. That yeast, the scientific name of that yeast is Kodamaya omeri. So the Kodamaya is the genus and omeri is the species. When that yeast touches pollen, it starts to produce some of the components of honeybee alarm pheromone. And researchers at the USDA lab in Gainesville, Florida, have shown that that can attract beetles to colonies. And so the individuals here saying, well, if beetles are attracted to fermentation, if we use brewer's yeast in our pollen patties and they kind of have a little bit of fermentation, will it attract beetles? So back to the short answer is, we don't know, but my suspicion is it's, it certainly won't detract beetles. It's in the very least, pollen subs are attracted to beetles anyway. So my guess is the smell of any fermenting product in a pollen sub could attract even more beetles. So the jury's out, but you know, I'd be a little leery of doing that. And if I did it, I'd want to make sure and check those hives regularly just to make sure that there's no beetle explosion.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for your questions. We've got a list of questions that, you know, we'll be having to go through in the next couple of months. So hold off if we haven't answered your question yet, or feel free to send up any follow-up emails, messages on Facebook, Instagram, or I used to say Twitters, but I guess it's now X. So any one of those social media platforms.
Thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. For more information and resources on today's episode, check out the Honeybee Research Lab website at ufhoneybee.com. If you have questions you want answered on air, email them to us at honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu or message us on social media at UF Honeybee Lab on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. This episode was hosted by Jamie Ellis and Amy Vu. This podcast is produced and edited by Amy Vu and Sarah Sowers. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.